Welcome to All Sides Weekend with Eric French. This is a new monthly local music program, and once a month or so, we'll be featuring some of the people from the Columbus music scene. And on today's program, we'll have a few different guests, and they're all they all wear many hats, but they're all educators in one way or another. Right now, I'm joined in studio by Stan Smith. Stan is a performer, a composer, and he's also a music teacher and a professor at Capital University. So the track we just heard coming into the show, that was original music by Stan Smith. So, Stan, you want to tell us what we just heard?
Yeah, that's was a recording that was done back in the late 90s, if I remember right, with a group that Roger Hines has called Nova Madrigada. And it's a group that we just play our own music. And so that was funded in part by some fellowships that I got from the Ohio Arts Council and the Greater Columbus Arts Council, some composition fellowships that I got. So with the money, I recorded a couple CDs. And
It sounds great. I mean, it sounds like it was recorded yesterday. So tell me about your compositions. Is everything you write in the jazz realm?
Not intentionally. I think most people who hear it put it there. Mm-hmm. But there are some things. In fact, one of the I think the last thing that we're going to be hearing from the program today is something that sounds quite a bit different. So I just really write what I hear and what I feel, and it tends to come out that way.
So what did you grow up listening to? What musically inspired some of this?
Well, what I grew up listening to is a little bit different than what inspired that. Mm-hmm. Listened to every Saturday night, as soon as we could sit up by ourselves, we'd go to the square dance.
I did that too.
Yeah. So there was a live band, you know, pedal steel, acoustic guitar, drums, and, you know, fiddle, calling square dances, and then 20 minutes of round dancing, which was just popular country tunes and rock and roll of the day. So, you know, listening to pop music, I was born in 1953, so, you know, doing that. But then my brother is 4 years older than me, is a drummer. He introduced me to a lot of music. And through him and a good friend of mine, Bruce Hartung, another musician who I went to school with, gradually it was introduced to blues and jazz. And when I heard the real blues, you know, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Buddy Guy, that just kind of changed everything. And then when I heard a Kenny Burrell record, I could feel that blues that blues feeling to it, but also he had this amazing sound, and the chords is what really got me.
Yeah, I think the first jazz blues sort of blend that I heard that I really loved was Kenny Burrell. Something about that tube amp that he played, it just sounded amazing. So let's stick on your compositions for a minute here. You know, I've seen you live a number of times, and I've heard a lot of your recordings, and they often have different performers, different instrumentations. I've seen you perform with vocalists, a lot of instrumental stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of people in the pop world, I guess, kind of write for themselves to play or to sing. How do you, I mean, I'm guessing that it's not always the same for you writing instrumental.
No. It's kind of hard to say. What I hear usually keeps changing as I hear it in my head. So that's why as much as possible, I use musicians who are comfortable improvising. And I tend to like to group together individuals rather than certain instruments. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking for personalities. And so there's the combination of just music that I hear, but I also try to keep writing even if I'm not inspired. So some of it is just something that, I haven't written anything for a while. Let me write something, I'll just figure it out. So it's a balance of some of it is pure inspiration and some of it is figuring something out.
And so do you think that... there's kind of like there's skill and there's craft and, you know, talent and all those that kind of are all slightly different from each other. So you're saying that even when you're not necessarily feeling something amazing, if you just keep writing, can that spark?
Well, yeah, I think it's important. Personally, I feel that if I'm going to call myself a writer, then it's that I have to write whether I'm inspired or not. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think that a writer is someone who writes whether they're inspired or not.
Yeah.
You know, it's not very difficult. If you hear something, then there's no challenge there other than grabbing it. But yeah, I think that it's important. If I call myself a writer, I'm going to write whether I'm inspired or not.
Okay, well, you brought a couple more things in, a couple more CDs. Let's play a clip of one. Tell me which one you want to hear next.
The next one is called Cross the Log. This is a session also as another incarnation of Roger's group, Nova Madrugada. This was done in 2004. Was in Los Angeles and organized a recording there with Ralph Jones, amazing multi-reed instrumentalist. My brother Stephen Smith is playing percussion. Roger's on bass, of course. And on this one, we had an African trumpet player, Lamine Dia. It's a great story, but we don't have time for it. But I think you hear Lamine on that.
Next time.
Yeah. But this is a tune that was inspired by Albert King's Crosscut Saw.
Okay, so I used to run sound at a blues nightclub 5 nights a week. So for 3 years times 5 nights a week, I heard Crosscut Saw at least by one act, sometimes more than once. And I gotta admit, that's one of the numbers that I don't often hear a version of and think, wow, that's fresh, that's cool. But that was cool, Stan.
Thanks. I also need to mention that was Tadashi Namba was the he recorded it and did the mastering, and he played all the keyboard parts.
So as a performer, as a songwriter, what do you consider success in a composition?
I would say when I feel that I have honestly represented what I was intending, and I've handed something that the musicians can use to project themselves through. And the final test is that someone hears it who doesn't know me at all and gets touched by it.
So you wear many hats. You perform, you teach, you compose. What's the balance in your life?
Well, probably the easiest way to explain that was that I make most of my money from teaching at Capital University. And then performing, and then I set aside my writing. I don't do my writing for money. I'll take money for it, but that's the one thing that I won't compromise. Actually, I don't compromise my teaching either. That's interesting. I just thought about that. So teaching, playing, and writing, they're all equally important, but as far as how I make a living, it's in that order.
Mm-hmm. So when you're writing, well, I mean, like you just said, you know, somebody hearing it and, you know, connecting with it is great. Are you imagining an audience when you're writing, or are you just Mm-mm. trying to write for yourself?
I'm trying to write for myself because I figure the most respectful thing I can do is to present the best that I have. And then just see where it lands.
So, as you know, as a musician who works, you know, you're not always performing your own music. How do you determine what gigs you take?
Well, first of all, I have to make sure there's something that I feel that I can actually deliver. Sometimes I get calls for something that I have no business even accepting. And then I just make sure that I think that's the bottom line. If somebody, you know, is giving me an opportunity to perform, as long as I feel that I can deliver it, then I'll take it.
And like teaching, you know, obviously you work at Capital University. Do you have any control over who you teach?
Yes, I have complete control over who I teach. I have
my
world there is really ideal. It's really remarkable what they have allowed me to do for these past more than 30 years. They've never told me how to teach, mm-hmm. and if someone wants to study privately, they have to audition. And also, out of all of the guitar students, then there's more than I can handle, which is intentional. I want to make sure that we have more than one teacher. I feel it's important for them to have more than one teacher. So I feel, basically, I think if it's an incoming freshman, then I like to get my hands on them early because there's some things that I want to impart to them. And then after that, I just determine who I think is a good fit for me and them.
And what is it that you're looking for during these auditions?
I'm looking for someone who really cares about learning and someone who's going to pursue learning fearlessly. So I take as much time as I can. And when I listen to them, I listen to see what kind of a connection they have to the music, period, not just their instrument. And then when I talk with them during the audition process, I notice how engaged they are. If I make a suggestion, do they argue with me, which sometimes happens, or do they actually, you know, try it? Are they looking at me in the eyes, you know, or are they trying to avoid me? Because really, for a university, I have to make sure that I bring in someone who I feel is going to be a good student as well as an inspired artist.
So if somebody's out there and they're considering, you know, a couple different options, you know, what if somebody wants to be a music major at Capital or at any school? How does somebody prepare? Because, I mean, obviously there's, like you said, there's the drive to learn and there's, you know, the love for it. But, I mean, there's got to be a certain quantitative amount of knowledge that they've got to arrive with.
There has to be some preparation. Fortunately, at Capital, we have options. To be a Bachelor of Music major, and that's either in performance or music industry or something along those lines, you have to have some kind of a foundation of music knowledge. It doesn't have to be complete, otherwise you wouldn't need the education. But there has to be a basic understanding of some of the theoretical concepts. Fortunately, they also, at Capital, we treasure the ear as well as the brain. So if someone comes in with really good ears but is not a really strong sight reader, then that's a balance that we respect because both are essential.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if someone is really passionate about studying music but has not had access to a foundation, then what they can do is come in as a Bachelor of Arts major, either a Bachelor of Arts in Music or a Bachelor of Arts in the Music Industry, where they're not required to take a lot of the music classes and they're not required for the same amount of lesson levels, but they can at least get started. And in some cases, when they actually start taking lessons and get in the environment, then they either go ahead and rise up to the top or they realize, okay, then the intellectual part of music I need to put in a different place. And so there are options at Capital, but every university has its own criteria as far as what they're looking for.
And what about music education for somebody who's not looking at the university level, doesn't want to maybe be a professional? Let's say somebody, you know, in their 30s, 40s, or beyond, who's just, you know, been a music fan, and, you know, I mean, is there a time that's better to start? Is there a time that maybe...
I don't think so. I think it's really a personal thing. I think one thing, too, we need to recognize is that a college music education isn't the only type of music education to get. There are a lot of people that is the wrong way for them to go. You're never too old to learn, but, the private lessons are as effective as sitting in a classroom. You know, there are advantages to each one, so you really have to serve yourself, but it's never too late. I've had students come to me in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and they get as much out of it and for their own self, you know, for what they're looking for at least.
So my guest is Stan Smith, a performer, educator, and composer, and we've only got a few more minutes left here. So I just want to ask you a couple more questions, Stan. Like, what are you listening to now? What do you listen to that you get excited about listening to?
Well, let's just go with the last thing I listened to. I got the newest recording of Rokia Traoré. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. She's a musician from Mali. Every recording, and I've got more than a dozen, of any artist from the country of Mali has been somewhere between really good and just amazing. So I'm listening. I always listen to her records, and I can't stop listening to certain types of Brazilian music, especially the music from the area called Minas Gerais. And so Milton Nascimento was a big influence. I never stopped listening to him. I love listening to Bartok and Berg and Miles Davis. I can always put any Miles Davis album on and know that I'm going to be engaged for the time.
Anything, any interesting projects in the works right now?
I am working with Danny Aguiar, a local Brazilian drummer. He has a group called Canta Brasil. And that's a really good group for me. He's forcing me to do things that are really good for me. He's stretching me quite a bit.
Cool.
We play Brazilian, I guess you'd qualify it as Brazilian jazz, the kind of the style that would emerge in the 70s and 80s. We have a gig coming up November 21st. Is that right? Yep, November 21st at Rumba Cafe. But Canta Brazil, that's a really interesting project.
November 21st at Rumba. Is that one of their, is that a late night or is that a happy hour show?
It's a late night, yeah.
Okay. So we're almost out of time here, but for everyone listening, where can they find you online? Where can we hear your music? Or find out about gigs?
Okay. StanSmithGuitar.com.
StanSmithGuitar.com. This is All Sides Weekend with Eric French. I'm joined in studio by Stan Smith. And we're going to have to take a break right now. We're going to play another cut of Stan. Stan, what do we have lined up here?
This is
the last one.
Okay, this is a project I did with Paul Brown, another guitarist and composer. We did a collaboration several years ago called Bicycle. So this is the title track of Bicycle.
We'll be right back on All Sides Weekend with Eric French. That song is Swinger of Mine by Eric Nesda. He's in studio with us right now. And Eric, that is definitely my favorite song of yours.
Thank you.
I play it as often as possible. Eric Nesda is a singer-songwriter. He's a speaker, an educator. He tours as a singer-songwriter, as a speaker. He performs regularly at Nashville's Bluebird Cafe. He hosts the Songwriter Showcase at Natalie's, which he also created, and you know his list of achievements and accomplishments are too long here to really list. So Eric, thanks so much for taking the time to be here.
Well, it's a privilege to be here. I appreciate your invitation, and it's always a privilege and an honor to be on your show.
So let's talk about the song "Swinger of Mine." Tell me about it.
Well, a friend of mine who does a radio show, car show, called me and said, "Do you have any songs about cars?" And I didn't want to say no, but the truth was I didn't. So I said, "Oh, let me check my catalog." And I went out to the garage right after our conversation. I opened up the hatch of my van to unload my gear from a gig the night before. And that first line, she was a swinger with a skinny rear end, came to me, and I thought, I've got to write a song now about my first love, which was my Dodge Dart Swinger.
I've been attempting to write a song for a motorcycle that I have that I love. So, yeah, anytime I hear songs about cars, I immediately love them.
Well, we got that one on Car Talk. They asked to play it, and that's always fun.
Okay, so you're a singer-songwriter, and you play at the Bluebird Cafe. Tell me, I mean, what is the Bluebird Cafe and why is that significant?
Well, the Bluebird Cafe is known as probably the premier venue in the world for singer-songwriters. Because it's based in Nashville, they get the very best people who both tour and who are based there. And you'll hear the top songwriters sing their hits. And it's always interesting to me to hear the songwriters themselves sing the songs as opposed to the artists who record them. I always prefer to hear the songwriter because it comes straight from the heart. And then you also have emerging songwriters, but it's always top quality down there no matter what, whether it's an early show or a late show.
So the craft of songwriting, I don't know. I mean, would you call songwriting a craft?
Well, that's... I think about that. A lot of people call it a craft. I think of it as an art. There is craftsmanship to it. There are things that we have to know. There are rudiments to it. But I think that sometimes it can extend into art. Those are usually the songs that aren't understood.
So, when you listen to a song, let's pull you out of a songwriter mind frame for a moment.
Okay.
So when you're just kind of driving and listening to a song, you know, how do you break down what is a good song? A finely crafted artistic song.
I think first and foremost the way it makes me feel, but I think that a great song for me is one that really merges the head and the heart and the body. You know, when you have the physical, the emotional, and the intellectual together, all three of those are stimulated. I think that's what makes a great song.
Let's hear another track of yours. This one's called Gold.
Yeah.
What do you do when you don't win the gold? When no one's there to hear you tell the tale you wanted told? And what do you do when you know your chance is through and you gave it all you had? But no one will remember it but you.
Talk about connecting the head and the heart there.
Thank you.
So tell me about that one.
Well, that was a song I wrote quite a while ago. I was in growing up, my teenage years, I was a runner, very committed to that. And by the way, running is a great, great way to prepare for a life as a writer. There's so many parallels to it. But I didn't achieve all the goals that I wanted to as a runner. And I was watching the Olympics one year, and this song just fell out. And it's all about not winning the gold and putting your soul into achieving something and not having it come true. And the idea is that basically what makes the champion, what makes the experience worthwhile, is the process. That the things you learn along the way about yourself and about life and the experiences you have are really the reward, not necessarily the gold medal.
Well, you mentioned running being a great preparation for songwriting. I know that you're also you also teach speaking and you're also a public speaker. How did those? I mean, it would seem like those two might have a parallel too. How do they tie in together?
Well, you mean songwriting and speaking?
Yeah.
Well, I teach speech part-time at Ohio Wesleyan University, and it's really been a wonderful thing because I'm able to see young people take risks and develop, but it's been very educational for me as well. And I think that every form of communication, whether it be public speaking, songwriting, dance, whatever it is that you do to communicate, even the written word, I think they all inform each other. And there are lots of things that parallel. And the way that I boil it down is I say that it's not about perfection. It's about connection. And that's kind of the theme of our classes, connection, not perfection. And it comes down to really knowing who you are as a person and as a communicator, being comfortable with that, and then learning the rudiments and honing the rudiments that we need to in order to be able to articulate and connect our particular messages and our feelings and our thoughts.
So tell me about teaching songwriting specifically. I mean, is it even something that can really be taught?
Well, that's a good question. I think that songwriting is a seed that's planted within us. I think that you probably either have the gene or you don't, if you want to put it that way. But there are definitely, and I've really come to appreciate this a lot more over the last decade with all the work I've been doing in Nashville, there are definitely some things that we can learn, rudiments we can hone in order to become more effective songwriters.
Tell me about some of the songwriter showcases and nights that you are involved in.
Well, the McConnell Center in Worthington's been really at the center of this whole movement. Worthington's really becoming a center of songwriting, and they opened a few years ago, and there are a lot of events going on there. We have the First Tuesday Songwriter Series, which is really open to anybody. They can come in and play their songs, and then we have a young songwriters circle that we do every third Sunday. We also do regular shows there with songwriter rounds. So lots going on at the McConnell Center. And then at Natalie's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what is a songwriter round?
Well, any number of songwriters, anywhere from 3 to 10, might sit on a stage or in a circle and just go around and sing their songs. And an open circle is one, or it's also known as a guitar pole, is one where anyone can come in and share their music. And then for the performances, though, songwriter round is the same kind of thing, but it's usually limited to a smaller group of writers, and there's an audience for that. And then from that grew a songwriter showcase at Natalie's, which with the help of Charlie Jackson at Natalie's, I put together a little over a year ago. We just celebrated our first anniversary. And we get for that, that's really the top writers based in Columbus and elsewhere, professional and touring writers who do that. We get 3 writers twice a month to come in and do a songwriter round, which is, again, taking turns doing their songs. It's been wildly successful. One of the reasons is that Natalie's understands that in order to make it a music venue, the audience has to be willing to listen. And it's just a great listening room to come into.
Yeah, I was actually shushed there once.
Oh, you were? Okay.
I was getting too wild. So critique for a songwriter. I would imagine that when somebody's bearing their soul out there, I could see how critique could be misinterpreted possibly as hurtful or painful.
Well, you know, there's a real art to critiquing. And I think that it's kind of like operating heavy machinery. If you don't know what you're doing, you're better off to let someone else do it or not do it at all. You know, particularly in the formative years, young writers that are just beginning to write, a critique that's not dealt with in a positive way can be very discouraging, and nothing hurts me more than to hear a young writer say, gee, I'm never doing this again. I played my song and nobody liked it, or whatever. And there are keys to critique. And the number one thing is to first and foremost, and in a most pronounced manner, focus on the strength of that person as a writer or performer or whatever it is, and then try to help that writer understand what he or she can do to make that song, those scenes in that song or whatever, come more alive, to connect more with the audience.
So what advice do you have for somebody who's new to the craft?
To sing out as often as possible.
Sing out in public
as often as possible once you're ready to. Mm-hmm. And to just keep believing and listening. I think the most important skill that any communicator can have is to listen. Listen to what other people are doing, but really listen to your audience. Listen to people's reactions. Listen to informed professionals who can critique well and teach well and that kind of stuff. We don't always get the best feedback from our friends, mm-hmm. or, you know, our family. It's that, you know, oh, everything's great or whatever. I think it can be very helpful to be in a situation where people who've been in the craft for a long time can help.
And maybe aren't, you know, personally committed to you in some way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, I've done a number of events, local music in the past few years, and it really seems like Columbus has a lot more talent than one would really think for a city of our size. And, you know, you've worked in Nashville, you've been all over. How does Columbus, Ohio compare?
Well, there legitimately is a ton of talent here, and especially, you know, having worked with the McConnell Center and Natalie's over the last couple years, I've been privileged to see it. It really is we have young writers that are great, and we have very established veteran writers who are great, who have great credits. And, you know, I'm working as hard as I can to expand the tent, to make the writing community as large as possible, because we all have something to gain from each other.
My guest is Eric Nezda, and this is All Sides Weekend with Eric French. We've only got a few minutes left. So, Eric, I just wanted to ask you, what projects do you have going on right now that you're excited about?
Well, one thing I'm really excited about is happening at the McConnell Center, and we've just shot three to five pilots for a TV series we want to get going with Columbus-based writers. And the McConnell Center has been, you know, just really instrumental in getting that off the ground. And details will follow, but we have a lot of stuff in the can right now, and we're looking for things to fall into place for that. Very excited about that. I'm always writing and performing. I'll be back in Nashville after the first of the year, and back at Natalie's and the McConnell Center. So whatever creative thing is coming around the corner is the thing I'm most excited about.
All right. So I know that you have a new song, and it's kind of timely, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it's timely. You know, this month we're talking about the loss of someone that America's never gotten over, and you know, it seems like she just never will.
You want to go ahead and play us out with it?
Sure. It's been many years since she last saw his face, and in all that time she hasn't found a man to take his place. Just look at her, you'll see for sure it's not she hasn't tried. She's been looking ever since he died. And she says she doesn't feel much like America. And she hasn't since November 63. And she says he could have made her into all she hoped to be. But Lord knows we all need a fantasy. America calls hers Kennedy. Since he died, she hasn't cared as much for right or wrong. And she says she isn't feeling quite as beautiful or strong. She says she just can't bring herself to trusting someone else. Or is it that she just can't trust herself? But she says she doesn't feel much like America.
And this is All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Thanks for joining us today. Sunshine and a high of 51. Cloudy skies for tonight and a low of 40 degrees. Mostly cloudy Saturday, and we'll reach a high near 60.
Professional wrestling. It may be fake, but the pain, the physicality, is very real. Journalist David Shoemaker explores the contradictions in and outside the ring.
When something real intervenes, you're left to wonder at what point the unreality and the reality converge.
The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling, on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides Weekend with Eric French. I am joined in studio right now by Dwight Heckelman. He's here from GrooveU. Dwight, tell me what GrooveU is all about.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely.
GrooveU is a brand new, we're in our second year of operation, music career program, two-year music career program right here in Columbus, Ohio.
So music career, I mean, that can span so many different things. Are we talking performance, technology, management?
We're primarily talking the business and technical side of music as part of what we do. So our courses of study and areas of study are audio production, music business, live sound, music for video, and interactive.
Okay, so Well, obviously, I work in the technical field here, and I've seen your name around. I've seen Groove You around a little bit, but I really didn't know anything about it. And when I started looking around online, I was surprised at how big of an operation it is.
Hopefully.
Yeah, pleasantly surprised. How did this all come about?
Well, the backstory is I've spent about 20 years in the music industry before I started the career in education for music. I'd launched after working at record labels and music publishers and recording studios. I launched the music technology program down at Hocking College in 2005, and that was followed up by working at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And you know, it was through those experiences that I kind of came to the realization that I think higher ed is getting it wrong as it relates to the sort of the technical study of music and everything it's going to take to succeed. And so I left Berklee, and people said I was crazy because nobody leaves Berklee. And that's not a dig against Berklee, because Berklee is a great school. To come back here to Columbus to actually launch this program in 2009, it took about 2 years to get it off the ground, and we started our first class last year.
Great. So with the technology changing at the rate that it is, you know, when I started in technology, tape machines were kind of on their way out, and ADATs and DAT tapes, digital
sure.
tape was kind of the thing. And, you know, things were kind of getting to the point where a normal person could actually find the resources to learn about and own some of this gear.
Right.
But it seems like in the past 10 years, things have exponentially skyrocketed.
Sure.
I mean, to the point where I've seen people collaborating with each other by plugging their guitar into their phone.
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, where is technology right now, and how do you embrace what's now, and how do you stay on the cutting edge?
Well, in terms of success in the music industry, it's always been sort of this exponential curve, right? You know, once for years we recorded one way, and then we had tape, and, you know, after tape came digital, and now we're kind of almost post-digital, you know, at the speed at which things are moving. So it is important from an educational perspective. What we tend to embrace is not necessarily the newest, freshest piece of equipment, because it always takes a while for that to sort of cycle through. I mean, if you look around town, the recording console in most studios, everybody's using about the same one. It's a Control 24, and it's the middle ground, and it's been that way for a few years. Now, if that changes, of course, we'll adapt to that. But it's almost more important to sort of understand how the business works, in terms of that it's a relationship-driven business, that it's based on apprenticeship, which is a really important thing to understand. Doing it. If you do it over and over, although the technology changes, the fundamentals don't, and you understand the fundamentals. And then to keep sort of creatively engaged in the business, both on the business side, being a creative person, and being an artist and a musician.
So who do you have teaching here?
There's kind of a couple key metrics for our instructors, because the music industry is so relationship based and so entrepreneurial in nature. Every instructor at Groove U has to have either owned or been senior management at a music industry enterprise. So our instructors range from, you know, people who own recording studios, people who've worked for Live Technologies here in town, people who teach a class or two for us, but on the side they still have their own management company or booking agency or something like that. So that's kind of one of the really key metrics for us in terms of our instructors, is to have people teaching who've actually done it.
So when I think of music education, technical or otherwise, you know, I think of university based. You know, you sign up for classes, you have a curriculum, a certain number of years, mm-hmm. and you're tested, and then you get, your
right.
diploma. How do you compare to that? Is that part of the model that you think was effective?
That's a really interesting question. In a very real way, we're almost the antithesis of that. We have a 4-to-1 lab to class ratio. So for every hour of lecture, we have 4 hours of our students doing it. We do projects. Every class does a project inside the Columbus community every month. Our students ran the sound at Breakaway Music Festival and worked those stages. They've done Independence Day. They do Pachaka Chow nights. We bring in community organizations like the Columbus Steel Drum Band to record. You know, it's not your typical sort of go to class, sit there, hear me talk about it type of education. Having said that, you know, we follow academic parameters. We're on 16-week semesters. Our students have a first-year curriculum that's the same for everybody, and then they pick an area of that they want to study. Like, they want to study music business, they get more advanced courses in that. If they want to study audio production, it's mixing and mastering courses. But we do two internships as part of our program. I think we're the only two-year school in the country that actually has our students do two internships inside 2 years. So it's kind of, like I said, it looks like a college when you go there. It's a real building. There's real classrooms. There's, you know, there's tons of lab space. You know, we have like 16 production suites and 2 big recording studios and a video shoot space. But while you're there, it wouldn't look like class necessarily.
Right. So, I mean, do people, you said they have an area of study. So, I mean, do you have a full staff? I mean, like when you're, mm-hmm. you have a whole bunch of people working there, mm-hmm. and I mean, is that their thing, 9 to 5?
Yeah, so, you know, we have several full-time staff members. We have numerous instructors that come in for their classes throughout the day, adjuncts or full-time instructors, if you will. I mean, you walk in, it's a 30,000-square-foot building. You know, it's a big space with big recording studios we have sort of what you'd view as a traditional classroom, but our classes, there's no lecture halls. So our classes are small by design. They're about 16 to 20 chairs. So we keep a really high instructor to student ratio.
And how is progress monitored or evaluated?
Oh, I mean, it's we usually monitor progress kind of 50% doing it and 50% sort of testing what you know. So, you know, we have quizzes and tests and things about subject matter, but then the other half of your grade, if you will, is usually monitored by the progress on the projects that we assign. So if you're going to record a band, how did that recording come out? And it's all very process-driven rather than product-driven.
And how many students do you have enrolled?
We have 17 this year.
And how many? Ideally, you know, how would you like this to grow?
Well, the building is designed to hold around 150 as would be maximum. I don't really have designs on being a 5,000 student Berkeley or a 12,000 student Full Sail, simply because at those types of ratios, I mean, we take our students to South by Southwest as part of their curriculum. So if you don't know what that is, it's a big music industry conference in Austin, Texas every year. You know, how do I get 4,000 students to Texas? How do I get 4,000 students a really meaningful project every month in Columbus to do music? How do I get 4,000 students quality internships? How do I get 4,000 students 4 hours of lab time a day? So right. It's really sort of a quality over quantity enterprise.
And how does somebody become a student?
It's pretty simple. We do almost everything online. The first thing you do is you sort of just fill out an interest form, say, I want to come check out the school. We'd bring you in, show you off our facility, our students, what they're doing. You can then enroll right online, and that sort of starts the next step of the process, or you apply, I should say, online, and it starts over the process. Every student at GrooveU goes through a one-on-one type of discussion with myself or a senior staff member to make sure that they understand that it's all music all the time. We're not a liberal arts school where you can say, hey, music sounds fun. You'd like it for about 2 weeks and then you'd probably hate it. But if you really love music and really want to be a part of sort of the commercial side of music, then, and we're on the same trajectory, then we admit you and off we go.
So what are the majors or areas of focus? So, I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. I want to be a recording engineer.
Sure.
But what else can you help somebody?
Sure. So develop? In addition to sort of the various technical careers that are, you know, studio engineering, we do live sound as well. We're kind of proud of that element. It's kind of unique where students can learn how to design and install live sound installations or run live sound engineering. We also have a pretty strong music business track, which involves things like artist managers, record label people, booking agents, talent promoters. We're not a film school, but we do offer music for video. So you can learn how to sort of, with YouTube, this is a great example of that technology question, with YouTube being the big phenomenon that it is, and music videos being sort of the primary discovery tool. we can help students learn how to shoot those types of videos on a budget, sync up the music properly, put out some nice high quality productions. And then we also have an interactive component, which is music for web design. If you were interested in sort of figuring out the next Spotify's or doing multimedia websites, that's what we do as well.
So are you setting yourself up to be an alternative to a traditional college?
Are you trying to recruit students,
you know, once they graduate from high school to come on?
Right. So what we find with our students is they kind of fall in one of two camps. They're looking to study music, but the idea of going to 4 years of music composition in theory, trying to be a classical orchestra player or a composer in the traditional sense has zero appeal. So they've been out there for a year or two trying to figure it out. They'll come to us, they'll find us. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and a lot of times they've been in those programs at other schools and they've dropped out or decided that it wasn't for them and they find us. So our students do tend to skew a little bit older, but we've got our first sort of crop this year of high schoolers who knew their junior or senior year of high school that, you know, traditional ed wasn't for them. And traditional ed is expensive. So in a career that pays an average of maybe $47,000 a year, it doesn't make a lot of sense to rack up $200,000 in student debt, right? You know, if you can get off for a fourth of that and get a really solid start, then you're kind of ahead of the game too.
Yeah, so let's talk about financing. Mm-hmm. Compare your rates to, say, a traditional college, and you know, what options do you offer?
Sure.
Can students get grants?
Sure. So we can't take federal financial aid yet. We're working on that. We're also working with the state to set up a program. But, you know, the average cost per year of college education is about $35,000. That would be room, board, all-inclusive. That's kind of where you land. You know, our tuition is $25,000 a year, and it is all-inclusive. So students get their Apple MacBooks, all the software, all the hardware, recording interfaces, their trips to South by Southwest, their internships. There's not another check a student writes me during a year. Oh, we host their websites and build all their domains and all that type of stuff for them. So we try and be as pure and transparent as we possibly can so that it's a real number. And we do have private lending options set up and payment plans. And most students seem to find a way when they see that for the money, they're getting an awful lot of value.
The way you're describing it, yeah, sounds like it's student-focused rather than institution-focused.
Yeah, that's a really astute observation that we kind of start and end every discussion with, is this best for the student? And if it is, we'll find a way to do it. An example of that might be our students last year, and they're doing it again this year, are doing InstaBand, which is a huge high school battle of the bands. So they develop the promotional material, they go out to the schools, the bands submit, they screen the bands, and it's bands in any genre. So last year we had EDM, and singer-songwriters, and rappers, and metal bands. They run the show, they run the sound, the stage, the lights, the backline. They shoot documentaries of every band that comes in. The band that wins actually gets to record an EP at Grooveview. And then our students are the ones who record the EP and shoot their music video. So, you know, it's as much hands-on and sort of driven by the student as we can possibly do.
So you said this is a two-year program?
It is. Two solid years. So students start in the fall. They go fall, spring, internship. They go fall, spring, and they do a second internship before they're a graduate. So they really graduate at the start of the following fall.
So you're in your second year?
We are.
And so that means you've got a batch of students about to graduate.
We do.
And I mean, you know, what are these students expecting?
Well,
what can they expect?
It's pretty cool. It's kind of played out how, like we hoped it would. Some of our students this past year for their internships, one of them went to the West Coast, got hired by a band to go on down the West Coast and shot a video documentary for the band for his internship. And then the band used that to raise $15,000 on Kickstarter. Another one of our students went to New York and worked in some recording studios to intern. So I fully expect that a lot of our students will be kind of entrepreneurial in nature and will start their own things. And I fully expect about, you know, the other half will land recording positions or booking positions with other companies. So
So we don't have a whole lot more time left here, but I wanted to ask, I saw that you have an advisory board.
We do.
And I recognize a lot of those names. Tell me about your board.
So this kind of goes back to your first question about how we might differ from other educational institutions. When I started GrooveU, the first thing I did was I wanted to shake off my own thinking of what this should look like. So I came back to Columbus and I put an advisory board together of people that were working in the music industry. And we asked them one really simple question. It's 2015. Well, I guess we beat that by a year. It's 2014. And we're graduating our first class. What do they need to have? What do they need to look? What skills, what attributes, how would you expect them to look, and why would you hire them over other graduates? And they told us, and we built our entire curriculum around what they told us. And every year, twice a year, three times a year, we meet with them. To your other question, how do we stay current? We ask them, what are you seeing? What are the trends? What new technology do our students need to be aware of? And then we find a way on the back end to work those ideas into the curriculum. Great example is this past summer we met, and one of our advisory members who books shows said, you know, festival business is now maybe 90% of what I'm doing. And I took a look at the curriculum and said, I don't think we're doing enough festival. So we need to change that. And, you know, we hired someone to teach that class that has festival experience. And I walked into class the other day and they were working on one. So that's what our advisory board does. And it's made up of Grammy-winning mastering engineers and nonprofits and entertainment attorneys and booking agents and just everybody in the business.
So it keeps your curriculum relevant.
Yeah, that's their main focus, is to make sure our curriculum stays right on that cutting edge.
My guest is Dwight Heckelman. He's from GrooveU. Dwight, tell me one more time where we can find you online.
Yeah, so you can find us at GrooveU, as in university, the letter U, .net. And you can find us in the Short North. We're right on Fifth Avenue, next to Neil.
Well, Dwight, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is All Sides Weekend with Eric French on 89.7 NPR News, and this is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. Just wanted to say thanks to Amy Jurevich for running the board for us, and also to Ann Fisher and her whole staff for all their help producing this program. We'll be back about every month to do a program on local music on 89.7 NPR News, so stay with us.